Kintsugi Heroes acknowledges funding and was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Find out more at cbf.org.au.
Welcome to the Kintsugi Heroes podcast, where we share inspirational stories of everyday people going through different challenges and how they overcome them. Please be aware that the story you're about to hear may have moments of deeply felt emotions and personal experiences. If anything you hear has a triggering effect, please reach out to someone who can help keep you safe. If you love this conversation, we'd love you to like and share it with your friends so we can continue to share more inspiration and hope to as many people as possible. Now, listen up for our next hero story. This conversation is with Barb Higgins. What a lovely lady Barb is, and her story, wow, it really was powerful. Barb has a story that focuses on, I guess, life, events and the traumas and the injustices and the pain and the things that happen in life that we have no control over. And this amazing journey of relationships and how they weave together in this dance called life. There's also an element of how she came out of and trusted in the process, and she trusted in herself and the miracle of life itself. And she shares all of this in this conversation. It's really powerful, beautiful story. And it wasn't just a story, it's Barb's life. She's just radiating joy and love for life. I know you're going to love this one with Barb Higgins. Hi, well, here we are. It's another episode. It's Kintsugi Heroes, and I'm here with Barb Higgins today. Barb, how are you going?
I'm good, okay. I'm doing all right. How about you?
I'm really well, thank you. Whereabouts are you from? There's an accent there, and I'm not quite sure.
Yes, so I live in Concord, New Hampshire, and New Hampshire is a state in the United States that's in the Northeast, sort of almost a couple of hours south of Montreal.
Wow.
Nowhere near you.
No, not at all. Don't you love the way that technology can bring us together? It's wonderful.
I do. It's wonderful indeed.
Yeah. Well, thank you for being here. I'm really looking forward to hearing your story. And I just want to, first of all, thank you for being, you know, so willing to give up your time and energy and share your story with me and all the listeners. It's it can take a bit to do this, and I just want to honor you for that. It does help people, and it gives them strength and courage.
Well, thank you. I actually am pretty honored to be considered have a worthy enough story for this, for Kintsugi Heroes. I just love everything about this podcast and everything that's connected to it and what it works for. I think sometimes the most important stories come from the least likely people. That's sort of a beautiful thing.
It really is. Yeah. All right. Well, let's get started. This is about you. It's about your story. I invite you now to take over the mic and take us back to the beginning and share your story.
Well, as I said before, my name is Barb Higgins, and I am as typical as they come when it comes to American women. I live where I grew up. I am a lifelong educator, wanted to be a teacher since I was a little girl, and have had one of those lives that has had the greatest of the greatest and the worst of the worst when it comes to experiences and time. In spite of all of it, every challenge that life seems to bring, I've been faced with the backed up against the wall decision to be okay and make good with what's happened to me, or let it consume me. And so the story I'm going to share is sort of the biggest of the big in terms of what I've gone through in my life. So I am 59 years old, and I didn't get married or have children until later in life, in my 30s. And I had a very, very rough childhood, and it was very tricky. And I just thought that if I stayed single and never had children, that I could sort of break the patterns that existed in my family around, you know, abuse and poverty and all of the things that can come with rural New England families, I think, although families anywhere. Went to college. I was a Division I All-American in track and field. I enjoyed a wonderful, you know, my 20s. I ran for Nike and traveled all over the United States and had a wonderful time being a competitive athlete. And then I returned home and began teaching in the district, the school district that I went to as a child. I got married and divorced, and decided that that was enough with marriage and had a few single years and then met Kenny and decided that maybe marriage would be okay. I had a baby early on that didn't make it out of my belly. And I thought that was the worst thing that could ever happen. I grew that baby for 25 weeks and had to deliver him. He had a very bad heart defect. And he plays into my later story quite significantly. But it was at that time that I decided maybe I did want to be a mother. And I gave birth to Gracie in 2001 and Molly in 2003. And I thought that there I was. My house is white. It has a picket fence. It represents the American dream. I could walk to the school I taught at. I lived in a community where I was connected and I knew everybody. And so I didn't think that, you know, any of these things would change. Life being what it is, decided to show me that life indeed could change. So the story I'm going to share begins with the sudden death of my daughter, Molly, and sort of culminates with the birth of my son, Jack. So yes, I am 59 and I have a 2-year-old son. So this is sort of where the story goes. So as I said before, I was just living a very, very typical life, a very lucky life. I have had, in spite of my struggles, I'm very, very privileged in terms of I live in a supportive community. I have a wonderful family. I have friends and a network around me that is supportive in every way. Shortly before my daughter Molly began to get sick, my life was in a bit of a turmoil. I had a job loss. You know, my marriage was suffering. We all go through these, you know, sort of traumatic and tumultuous times. Molly and Gracie were becoming teenagers. It was 2014, 2015, when my life, sort of aside from Molly, sort of began to unravel. Molly was never sick, so I never had all of this time that I could try to heal her or get ready for her death. Molly was alive, and then she wasn't. In the spring of 2016, so right, really, April is a very hard month for me. 7 years ago this month, Molly's behavior began to change, and she began to suffer from headaches and vomiting and all sorts of bizarre symptoms. And we had minimal luck with the doctors. They just seemed to sort of write it off as stress. They thought maybe she was too thin. They thought perhaps she had a sinus infection. Trip after trip to the doctor's office with 13-year-old Molly, oftentimes her sister Gracie in tow. Gracie was 15 at the time. And we couldn't seem to get any answers. Gracie and Molly are incredibly close, and they have been incredibly close since the day they were born. And I like to think that they're still incredibly close. If everything we believe about souls in the universe is true, then I think Molly's right here all the time. So as April marched along, Molly's behaviors and symptoms began to get worse, and we just trip after trip to the doctor's office. I went on a vacation. The last week of April is a vacation week in the United States. Schools are off. Well, in the northeast part of the United States anyway, schools are off and families travel. And I went with a friend to Amsterdam for a week, and I had a wonderful time. That vacation proved to be sort of one of my biggest regrets because it was the last week that Molly was alive. When I flew home, I was greeted with an unconscious Molly in an emergency room. And I was horrified. Her symptoms had gotten incredibly worse when I was away on this vacation. And Kenny, Molly's dad, had taken her to the ER via ambulance, which was the right thing to do, or so I thought at the time. During my week in Amsterdam, I had this clutching moment. I went to the Anne Frank Museum, and I had this rush of panic, and it coincided exactly with Molly here waking up in the night and vomiting, and Kenny and Gracie being very concerned about her. It was like 9 in the morning in Amsterdam, so it would have been 2 in the morning here. And I was sitting in this museum, and I'm reading all these beautiful words by Otto Frank, and something made me cry, and it was him reflecting on the fact that he learned so much about his daughter because he read her diary, which he never would have read had she not died. So he came to know and love his daughter in a profound way after her death. And it just gutted me. And I sat on that bench in that museum for a good 45 minutes trying to collect myself. So I flew home, you know, the vacation ended. I came back and went to the ER, and we spent 16 hours there fighting for medical care, fighting for a CT scan. You know, what's wrong? They wouldn't let us take her home, but they wouldn't do any testing, gave her medicine, made her sleep. And at the end of this time, a brain tumor ruptured in her brainstem and killed her. In an effort to, I think, buy themselves time and appease us and give us hope, they rushed her to a larger hospital and removed the brain tumor. But the damage had been done. And after a week on life support, with every intervention possible, we had to unplug Molly. So here's my life. I'm teaching, I'm coaching, I have friends, I have a social life. My daughters dance, they do theater. Gracie's enjoying her first year of high school. Molly's thriving in middle school, and it just blows up in my face is the best way to describe it. It was the only time I think I've understood what it might feel like to wake up to an earthquake and everything you know is in rubble around you. That's how my life felt at that time. And so began, you know, sort of the next piece of my life. We have, as I said, a community that loves us, and Molly's death affected hundreds and hundreds of young people and old people, quite honestly. Molly was a light, and she was a fighter for those who couldn't fight for themselves. She was the first one to notice when something was wrong, or somebody was being mistreated, or somebody didn't have something they needed. So I packed her two lunches a day all of her life, and she gave away things like her Easter basket and her favorite Christmas present. And, you know, she would earn points in class, and you could pick prizes out of a raffle, out of a basket, you know, or win a raffle with your homework tickets. And Molly would pick the nicest thing and give it to the child that never had their homework in. That was just who she was. So we had several hundred visitors come to see her when she was on life support. I thought it would be a better way for her friends to say goodbye to her, rosy-cheeked. You know, she was all plugged in and everything, but she still looked like Molly. And that was a hugely helpful experience for me, quite honestly, because I learned so much about her. And I got to meet all these amazing people, children and their parents, teachers, the custodian at her school that used to leave candy in her locker because he watched her be so kind and helpful. And she would say hi to him. She called him Mr. John and said hi every day. And sometimes those people are invisible. You know, you have a big building and the people that clean it blend in sometimes like they're less important. And that didn't sit well with Molly. So her funeral was a musical review. Molly Be the Musical, we called it. And 1,300 people came, filled that theater, and watched all of her friends perform, singing, dancing, scenes from plays, you know, all sorts of things. All the things that Molly loved to do were represented and dedicated to her in this amazing performance. And then that all goes away. You know, all that attention sort of stops, and life became very bleak for us. And I have to say, I think back to those times and I get a knot in my stomach and I'm terrified because I don't ever want to feel that way again. And I wouldn't wish those feelings on my worst enemy. Think of losing, like you lose your child in the mall, or you're a child and you lose your mom and you're in that panic stricken moment. Where is she? Where is she? Where is she? Oh my gosh. It felt just like that for months and months and months. Her death was so sudden that none of us had any time to prepare for it. My story sort of branches off in three sort of parallel journeys here at this time. So Molly died in May 7th. And around July, I started having all these funny dreams, strange dreams about having a baby. So I thought I was just crazy. You know, I'm suffering from you know, grief and trauma. And of course, I'm having these dreams. I didn't say anything to anybody. I didn't quite know how to manage them. But after a few months of these dreams, I went to my doctor and explained to her the dreams I was having. I went to my, you know, obstetrician, and she sort of wagged a finger at me and sort of scolded me and said, "You get that idea out of your head. You're far too old." I was 53 at the time. So she wasn't wrong necessarily. And I came home feeling a bit angry that I wasn't listened to or respected by my physician, and a little scared that, you know, maybe I was too old to have a baby. And what do I do with this dream and this voice in my head that's telling me to do this? And so I just sort of sat on that information for a while. Also at this time, Gracie and Molly's dad, Kenny, was getting sicker and sicker. He had a kidney disease and was just becoming more and more ill and weak. And of course, the death of a child does nothing for your health. And along with this as well, my ability to cope caused me to be taking all sorts of medication, psychological medication, anti-panic, help me sleep, help me wake up, keep me focused, you know, keep me numb, all of the medications that I think sometimes we overprescribe. I can't believe I could function on them all, but I did. I was wide awake all day and most of the night. I was also at this time really drinking a copious amount of alcohol. I could make it to about 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and then I was just done. I just had to have a drink and have several more and get numb. It was a truly miserable place to be. So I have all of this going on sort of at the same time. I was not working at the time. I quit my job and was trying to take care of Gracie. So I think back to these years as this undescribable hell where everything sort of looks normal, but nothing is normal. The months went along and the dreams continued. And also at this time, we entered into a lawsuit with the hospital and some of the physicians involved in Molly's death. And there is nothing kind or attractive about a medical malpractice lawsuit, nothing. Both sides, you know, my side is the death of a child. The hospital side is saving money and the reputation of their doctors. And it's an impossible scenario to find compromise other than a lawsuit that has some sort of settlement. So that was a 2-year experience for us. So in the beginning of, you know, the end of 2016, moving into 2017, that whole sort of first year after Molly's death, all of these things were going on. And I followed through on the baby thing, whatever it was at the time. I found a new obstetrician. He was completely supportive of me following through on this journey, just a different mindset. He steered me in the direction of several clinics in the Boston area. I found a clinic that accepted women in their 50s, this wonderful Italian obstetrician named Vito Cardoni. He's the most delicious human being ever, is the best way I can describe him. He's retired now. I was one of his last patients. And we also clicked. And so the testing is significant. I had to have a full battery of physical tests myself. And I had to, make sure that my body could actually, you know, grow a baby. And it's colonoscopy, mammogram, EKG, all these different tests to make sure that my body was healthy and solid. I did all this on my own. I had not yet included Kenny because I didn't want to include anyone to then find out I couldn't do it. I just thought I'll follow through and see if it can even happen. And I was given, the green light to do this in 2017, but we had no money. I wasn't yet working. I was still a disaster emotionally. And we were still thick in the lawsuit. And so I just looked at the sky and said, stop, I can't do this anymore. And so for the next 2 years, I lived a very, very bleak existence. And this would be, I think, the tragic part of my story. I don't think there's a right way to grieve. I will never in a million years tell anyone how to respond to traumatic events in their lives. I'm not them. I don't live inside their heart or their brain, and no one lives inside me. And I managed it terribly. I put on a good face. I took good care of my daughter. Her life was able to continue in a relatively stable way. The two of us slept on the living room floor for 2 years. We couldn't manage to come upstairs. You know, it was just too painful. Lots and lots of things of Molly's stayed right where they were, untouched. This we just lived in this frozen sort of bubble. And I abused all manner of alcohol and drugs at this time. I couldn't face anything. And Kenny got sicker and sicker and sicker. So you can imagine. I mean, you know, I had support and love around us. So I was never hungry and I managed to pay my bills as best I could. And, you know, I was safe in those regards. There are people that have it much worse in those areas than I did. I still had my home. I slept on the floor, but it was a comfortable floor. You know, I had all of that. As 2018 started, it was spring, went into summer, we settled our lawsuit almost 2 years to the day that Molly died. And once the lawsuit was settled and the financial pieces worked out, the dreams came back. And by this time I had shared with Kenny that I had done this process and I would have done it by myself. I wasn't relying on any, so I didn't have any details around the purpose of this child other than to have one. So Kenny jumped right on board. He said, I would love to be a part of this journey. He and I were struggling. Our marriage was, we had actually divorced by this time, but we were still living together. You can't separate your family when you lose 1/4 of it. So Kenny, Gracie, and I just became this trio of three doing the best that we could under our roof. But he was on board and game for this challenge. And so we were having coffee. It was like late June, early July of 2018. And I said, hey, Kenny, guess what dream I had last night? And he said, the baby dream. And I said, yes. And so we picked up and began the journey again. So the first thing that I had to do was go off all this medication. So I often say here that I acknowledge those people that are drug addicts and alcoholics, people that are truly addicted in a very unhealthy way to drugs, because this was the hardest thing physically that I've done. And I've done some pretty hard things physically. I'm a distance runner and a CrossFit athlete. I know what it is to hurt. And I've lost a child. So it's not like I haven't been in a bad place, but the physical side effects and the withdrawal effects of all the medications I was on was incredibly painful. So this was, you know, August of 2018, and it took me all the way until December. During this time, I had to redo a lot of the medical tests to make sure I was still 2 years later healthy enough to have a baby. I was 55 now, which in this particular clinic was the age limit. So I felt some pressure that I should, you know, I have to do this. As I went off all the medication, I began to have extreme jaw pain. So I have a condition called trigeminal neuralgia, which is a nerve condition in the brain. You have a nerve in the brain that controls your face, and it controls your eyes and then the middle of your face and then your jaw. And so my version of this disorder made me feel like I had a toothache all the time. And a toothache is horrifying, pain in the face. And so they treat it with pretty significant seizure medicine, anti-seizure medicine. So I realized there's no way that I can go off this seizure medicine. I'm going to hurt too much. How am I going to be pregnant for 9 months with a knife in my face? And so I found a neurologist. And there's a brain surgery that you can have to repair this mouth condition. So I met with Dr. Cardoni. This might hold it up a few months. I need to repair this. Is this okay? That's fine. You know, let us know when, you know, you'll need to have a, you know, permission from the neurologist to continue with the baby process. So I'm feeling hopeful now. It's December of 2018. I've turned, you know, we're 2.5 years now out. I'm not feeling better about Molly being gone, but I'm feeling a bit more able to manage life, and I'm going off all this medication. So things are becoming clearer, which was wonderful and awful at the same time. I could see and feel joy better, but I could also see and feel pain better. But I was optimistic. I'm following through. I'm going to have this baby. I just know it's going to happen. So I had to have an MRI to make sure the neurologist could fix my mouth. And he was located in New York City. So he simply said, schedule a local MRI. And once you have had it, schedule a follow-up with me and we'll see if we can fix your mouth. So I went and had the MRI. Gracie was a senior in high school at this time. Kenny was as sick could be. We're sitting at the kitchen table after my MRI and my neurologist calls me on the phone and I look at my cell phone. And I think, okay, you don't get a phone call 1 hour after a neurological exam with good news. You just don't. What is wrong with me now? And so I pick up the phone and say hello. And Dr. Tanase, my wonderful Polish neurologist, says to me in her very, very thick accent, I'm so sorry. Your MRI shows 3 brain tumors. So I'm just in stunned silence now because I spent, 6 weeks fighting for my daughter, Molly, to get her head looked at. And the whole time I was fighting for her, not knowing she had a brain tumor, I had them as well. So the hardest part for that piece of news was realizing that had I known I had brain tumors, I might have been able to save Molly. The other hard piece was Gracie, because she was just wanting to be a normal high school senior. She didn't want to be the girl with the dead sister. She didn't want to be the girl with the really sick dad. What she wanted to be was a normal high school senior. So now we have to tell her that not only does she have a sick father and a dead sister, but she has a mother with 3 brain tumors in her head. That was a pretty bad day, I have to be honest. That wasn't as bad as Molly's death, but it was a close second, because poor Gracie just doesn't know what to think. And she just wants to be happy and normal. I traveled to New York City, and this wonderful man, Dr. Eskandar, Imad Eskandar, he's from Turkey. He told me to come right down. I had the MRI was sent. And by the time I arrived, he had looked at it from every possible angle. And after several questions and a neurological exam, he said, well, I don't know how you're as healthy as you are with that giant tumor in your head, but it looks to be a benign tumor. It looks easily operable. You just tell Gracie that you are going to be fine. I will make sure of it. Which, you know, that's a pretty big promise for a doctor to make before you cut your head open. So I had all sorts of medical testing, and they were also, I didn't have medical insurance yet at the time. Although we had settled our lawsuit, the finances take a long time. And so I was still on sort of government supported medical insurance. So nothing gets approved. It's a very limiting network of doctors and all. And I don't know, they worked magic, because I never paid a penny for any of the treatment done for me at that hospital. So I returned to New York in January 10th, 2019. He told me it would be a little scar on the side of my head, not to cut my hair or anything. I woke up with half a head shaved and the biggest, most giant scar ever. It was a lot bigger than it looked. And he had to make some adjustments in the surgery. But he said it was benign. It was sitting right on my optic and auditory nerve, and it was compressing my carotid artery. So another 6 months to a year, and it likely would have killed me. It wasn't cancerous, but it was just in a very, very tricky place. So my first thought is, this is why I was supposed to have a baby. My big belief at the time was that Molly, in her wisdom on the other side, now knew I had this brain tumor and had to come up with a way for me to find it. You know, how can I get her off all that medicine? How can I make her find this brain tumor? I know. I'll make her have a baby. So that was sort of where my thought process, my thoughts actually remain that way now. I do believe in miracles. And this is where the miraculous side of my story begins to take place. I'm now really clean and sober from all of the medicines and the alcohol that were keeping me calm. I've had this massive craniotomy. I had to have radiation. And then I could have my mouth condition fixed, which was the whole reason I went to this neurologist in the first place. So from January through April, I was either getting my head cut open or it was getting blasted with radiation. In the meantime, Kenny is sort of getting sicker and sicker and sicker. But again, I have a family. My mother moved in. My sister-in-law moved in. We had all of this help. Gracie could just continue to live her life. I slept on a mattress in the living room for a long time, so I wouldn't have to go upstairs. Getting your head cut open twice does not do a lot for your vision or your balance or your ability to think. And so that was a pretty long, drawn out process. And nowhere during that time was I thinking about a baby. I was just really trying to be healthy and well. Gracie, Kenny, and I went to Florida at the end of April, which we do every year now. We don't like to be around at the time of Molly's hospitalization and death. It's just too painful. So we were in Orlando at Disney World, Walt Disney World. Kenny was unbelievably sick, and I had this bald, swollen head with giant scars everywhere. So we stayed at the home that we were renting with another family while everyone else went to the parks. And I was on my computer trying to distract myself. Kenny was, you know, getting sick and taking a nap and, you know, just miserable. And we saw that one of Molly and Gracie's dance friends was on life support. So when you've lost a child, one of the only ways you can feel useful is to help somebody else that's lost a child. It's a very specific, unique, horrifying little group of people, we bereaved parents. And so when I saw that another dance friend was on life support, same hospital, she was 20, turning 21, so a bit older than Molly, but still far too young to be that sick. Kenny and I immediately jumped into action, and you can do that from a sofa and a computer. And so we organized fundraisers and t-shirt sales and did all these things for this wonderful family. Rachel, the girl that was on life support, danced in Molly's memorial service. She was in the big opening number. So that family had a connection to Molly. We came home from our vacation and went up to visit this family, and their daughter had eaten peanuts and gone into anaphylaxis. And was unable to be revived. She had coded and, you know, essentially died in the ambulance, and they got her heart beating again, a lot like Molly. The tumor killed her, and they get her heart beating again and hope that she'll wake up. And she didn't. And so once we knew this, we really, really just enveloped this family into ours. And it was this is going to sound strange, but it was a really good distraction for us because we could focus on them and we could use our experience to be helpful, as opposed to just focusing on what we were still missing. So it's hard to explain without sounding sort of trite, and I don't mean it to sound that way. When Jen's mother, Rachel, realized that Rachel wasn't going to wake up, she asked if we donated Molly's organs, and we were not allowed to do that because we did not know at the time that we unplugged Molly whether or not her tumor was cancerous, and it was not. Kenny could have had one of her kidneys. I shared this with Rachel's mother. So Rachel's mother cocks her head and looks at me and asks what Kenny's blood type is. And it's the same as Rachel's. And I put that out. I said, I'm not here to talk to you about Rachel's kidney. I'm here to support you and help you say goodbye to Rachel. Rachel's 21st birthday was May 7th that year, 2019. May 7th is Molly's death date, the day we unplugged her. So we're at the cemetery saying goodbye to Molly for the third time. Rachel is in a hospital an hour away, celebrating her 21st birthday on life support, her last day, quote unquote, alive. And Jen, her mother, calls us on the phone and asks for Kenny's kidney transplant coordinator at Mass General because they want to give him one of Rachel's kidneys. This always makes me cry. So we're happy, like utterly happy and grateful and thankful, but we're getting it because Rachel's dying. So again, it just epitomizes my life, the best of times, the worst of times. With every amazing, amazing gift is some horrifying tragedy attached. And so And so on May 8th, Kenny went to the hospital and I went and got my head checked and Rachel was removed from life support and he received her kidney. So again, we're still in the throes of this horrific new reality. Molly's never coming home. Now Rachel will never come home. We've met this beautiful family who we are still close friends with now, obviously. And Kenny has her kidney. So a kidney that danced in his daughter's funeral now lives inside of his belly. And this is the best way to think about that kidney because it allows us to love Rachel and be grateful for her, but it keeps Molly alive as well. And it just sort of honors the whole process. So again, the whole process for having this baby just had us in places and times. Had I not tried to have the baby and was still taking all that medicine, had we been in Florida, we wouldn't have been home. I wouldn't have been looking. You know, all of the things that led us to be where we were at each of those times. Again, I just feel like Molly was up there just making it all happen. I also think Molly and Rachel spend a lot of time together now, making sure that we're okay down here.
Sorry for the interruption. This is Ian Westmoreland, the founder of Kintsugi Heroes, and thank you for listening to this story from one of our amazing heroes. Our mission is for these stories to provide hope and inspiration to people experiencing life challenges, and to also educate the broader community on how best to provide support. If you would like to help us continue to produce more hero stories and cover more adversity themes, we would welcome all donations. These can be made via our website, kintsugiheroes.com.au. The donate function is at the bottom of the homepage. We'd also welcome any feedback. You can email me direct using ian@kintsugiheroes.com.au. Now let's get back to the story.
That was the next phase. The summer of 2019 unfolds and I have several checkups and I have to do all manner of things to make sure I'm neurologically sound. And my neurologist signs off on me making a baby. So Gracie knows nothing of this. My mother knows nothing of this. We told nobody about this process. And I go back to my original reason for not telling Kenny in the beginning. We just wanted to go through it as far as it would take us. And if the outcome was negative or traumatic, it was our journey. We didn't pull Gracie into another trauma. We didn't involve the public or other people that might have a stake in our well-being or the well-being of a baby. So we said nothing. And so we went through all the, you know, there's a lot that goes into IVF transfers. There's egg extractions and sperm extractions. And if you use a donor, finding a donor and a live donor versus a frozen donor and sperm banks and embryo adoption, the IVF world is a profoundly, astoundingly beautiful place that makes me relook at life and conception and God and not God, all of it. It's just such a learning experience for me. I will never, ever take anything for granted when it comes to these kinds of things. And people with their amazing brains think these things up and invent them and create ways to help women become moms. It just blows my mind sometimes. And so our first round of IVF didn't work. We went through everything, the shots in the bum, the patches, the pills, all the timing of the hormones, all of it. And I knew right away it didn't work. I didn't feel any different. Every pregnancy I've had, all four of them. And when I get to Jax, I'll share that. I just know almost right away. So I wasn't all that upset, quite honestly. I just felt like perhaps it wasn't about the baby after all. We have brain tumors discovered. Kenny has a kidney. We have this amazing family connection now. Gracie has a quote unquote sister in her relationship with Rachel's younger sister, Allison. They are to this day, unbelievably connected young ladies. So I thought, okay, well, it wasn't about the baby then. The nurse, her name was Tammy. When I said to her, so should I stop taking all the estrogen and everything now? And she's like, well, just keep taking it. Cause I had, you know, you go for a follow-up. So I go down for my follow-up appointment to Dr. Cardone and we walk in and sit down. And he says, I was sure this would work. This was not a problem with your body. It was an embryo problem. I'm utterly amazed that you're not pregnant. So I sort of look at him and ask, well, can we try again then? And he grins at me and says, are you twisting my arm? And I said, only if you need me to. And he pulls out a list of different things to try and new ways to approach another round of IVF. So we make some changes. The most significant change is we got a fresh batch of Kenny's post-kidney transplant sperm, right? stronger swimmers, we think. So that was one of his thoughts. And so that was one thing that, you know, when Kenny put up a little bit of a fight, you know, he's had a vasectomy, so it's not an easy sperm extraction. They have to go in with a needle. And I'm like, well, then you've done your part. You know, I'm sorry if that's too personal, but it's a fun part of the story. We are all ready to have an IVF transfer sort of the end of March, end of February, beginning of March in 2020. And what happens then? COVID hits. And so everything is just put on hold, which for us was fine. We had the eggs, we had the sperm. I'm on the medicine. It doesn't have to happen at any specific time. So I was just sort of put into a holding pattern for March, April, and May. And, you know, we just all sort of waited with bated breath along with the rest of the world to see what COVID would bring. Once June arrived, certain aspects of the medical community could open back up. And so the IVF clinic that I was, you know, going to called and said, you're like top on our list here. Dr. Cardone was retiring at the end of July. And I think he wanted to be connected to it. You know, I was his person. So I went right, you know, jumped right back into the heavy duty, you know, injections in the tushy and patches on all that. Gracie, in the meantime, is in college, community college, really having a miserable time with all the COVID restrictions, but doing well. And again, we still kept her out of this. We hadn't brought her into any of this. She was really starting to come into her own. And I just felt like, as much as she might be angry at me down the road, I wanted her to have as much just sort of happy free time as possible. So I have the embryo transfer, which is what they call putting the embryo into the uterus. Dr. Cardone's last one. July 29th, I turned 57. August 5th, I find out I'm pregnant. So it was about the baby. At least I was hoping at that time. I had a fantastic pregnancy. For 13 weeks, we said nothing. I have a big mouth. I love to talk. But I learned in this process to keep my mouth shut. We had suffered too much. And anything can happen with any pregnancy. Just because I'm old doesn't mean it's going to be far worse for me. Young women, you know. So I said nothing for 13 weeks. And for the first 13 weeks, I was still under the care of Dr. Cardone. At 13 weeks, all the hormonal assistance stops and it becomes a regular pregnancy like anyone else's. This is where I thought if it were going to fail, it would. So I was in a sort of a panic-stricken phone call. Everything was fine, but I called my local OBGYN for some reassurance. Gracie overheard me on the phone. This is how she finds out I'm pregnant. That was a hard time for her. And I will never, ever in my life tell her how to feel about anything. She was furious. And so I just needed to give her permission to rage and be angry. We function well as a family. And so we can sort of push the pause button when it's dinner time. We can sit and have an enjoyable dinner and be authentic with one another. And then when dinner's over, she can go back up and slam her door and be angry at me. And so we had several weeks of this. I encouraged her to share it with her therapist and find a confidant, someone to share it with, that she could talk to about it. My health continued to be excellent. I work out at a CrossFit gym and I worked out 6 days a week, like I always did. That was a place that was hard to conceal the pregnancy because, you know, you're in a tank top and spandex, but I'm, you know, 57 at the time, menopause belly, right? Oh, I gained weight in my tummy. The number of times I said that as my tummy began to get bigger and all of my older friends would, yes, I know. Oh my God, me too. Isn't it terrible? You know, we'd commiserate about our menopause bellies. My local doctor told me I needed to be quiet now for another 9 weeks, go to 22 weeks. So two reasons he said that. One, I had a baby that didn't live inside of my belly 21 years prior. These things happen. And if I told the public that I was pregnant before we were sure that anything related to my age or the baby was fine and something went wrong, then I opened myself up and my family up for judgment, more trauma, all of that. So I just kept quiet. A small group of people knew, my CrossFit coaches and all of that. So finally at 22 weeks, I had the final test that I needed to have, which was a fetal echocardiogram. I had to go to the same hospital they had gone to with baby Gordy in 1999 when we looked at his tender little broken heart. So it was pretty stressful moment for me. I filled the technician in on all the details about Molly, all the details about Rachel, and of course, baby Gordy. So this young woman comes in. Well, she wasn't super young. The cardiologist comes in and she sits down and she looks very serious. So I'm immediately in a panic. And she says to me, tell me about your baby that you gave up, you know, that you lost years ago. What did you do with him? And I said, oh, I donated him to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia because they have a good neonatal heart unit, cardiac unit there. And he had this really bizarre heart disorder. And she goes, tell me what it was. And so I explained it all to her. And she looks at me and she gets a bit trembly. And she said, I performed the autopsy on that baby. So I'm sitting in a lab on my back, you know, looking at the inside of my belly on a screen, with a woman that held my child's body and took out his teeny tiny heart. So they were able to reproduce that heart on a 3D printer and learn how to make repairs and corrections in it that have now saved, I think, 11 babies. So I lost my baby, but by kissing him goodbye, and it makes me cry, and giving him away, there are mummies now that won't have to go through what I went through with that baby. And she got to see Jack inside my belly. So that was one of those moments that I don't think Kenny and I could talk for about 5 or 6 hours. If I wasn't pregnant, I would have gone home and had a drink. You know, like, it was just like, what is happening here? You know, and this is when I think, you know, Rachel and Molly up there are just getting a big kick out of all of this. But that was an incredible connection. It was also one of the signs to me that Jack was going to be fine. There was too many connections, too many unbelievable things that were far too big to be coincidences, and too many things to happen to one person. I have a book publisher that says, I wouldn't make a believable fictional character because one person couldn't go through all of this. And on this day, I felt that way. So the remainder of my pregnancy was, you know, unremarkable in terms of my health. I was super healthy. I was fine. The best part of it was telling people that I was pregnant, because the responses were, you know, mostly like stone face. Like, they would look at me and say nothing and just stare at me. What? So that was fun. I was in the gym one day and I said, oh, my menopause belly is getting huge. And my friend Pam says, yeah, you do look like you're getting some weight. I'm like, that's because my menopause belly has a heartbeat. And she just looks at me, not understanding what it is I'm saying. And so everyone in the gym that day just went nuts. They couldn't believe it, touching my belly and all this. And then, of course, you know, that last trimester, you really do explode tummy wise. So there would have been no keeping this a secret anymore. Jack was due April 13th, and right around St. Patrick's Day here, March 17th, I started to puff up. My blood pressure went up. I started to get all these bizarre symptoms, and I was diagnosed with preeclampsia, which, again, is not a good thing to have, but not necessarily because I was old. This was the one time in this whole journey that I started to wish I had more control. I wanted Dr. Chaudhary to deliver the baby. He was going on vacation, a vacation he planned early so he'd be here when I gave birth to Jack, but I had no control over it. This wasn't my decision to make. And so into the hospital I went to have Jack. I chose the name Jack because one of my bereaved moms that I've just now met in person, her son Jack died right around the time Molly died. And she and I had amazing connections to each other's children. I messaged her once to say, just so you know, I have your picture, Jack's picture on my fridge. And she emailed me back instantaneously with a picture of Molly on her fridge. And she lives on the other side of the United States. So we became close. So when I found out Jack was a boy, I chose to name him after her son. So Jack was the one push wonder. They gave me magnesium for my blood pressure. They gave me Pitocin to induce labor. I went to bed, fell asleep on a Friday night. I woke up Saturday, didn't think I was in labor. I wasn't having a hard time at all. They broke my water. Kenny arrived, and 2 hours of contractions and one big push, and out came teeny tiny, perfect little jingle jangle Jack. 5 pounds, 13 ounces, 18 inches of utter perfection. You know, other than the preeclampsia and other than him being a bit early, he wasn't considered premature, but definitely early. He had a little trouble navigating nursing. I was actually able to produce breast milk. He still breastfeeds a little more than I want sometimes, but I'm just going to soak it up. And so the first day of spring, March 20th, the vernal equinox, my sweet baby boy came into the world. So if I had to sort of look at all of this, him here has been life-changing. Gracie and he are closer than if he has to choose, he chooses his big sister. They have a connection that's remarkable. And I love it. It's helpful to me sometimes. And he just loves and idolizes her. I think sometimes too, it's a way Molly can connect with Gracie. I think she gets right in there. Children are so open to that. He's brought joy back into our lives. We've had incredible support, a lot of TV coverage and news media coverage. We shot a TV commercial in Utah for the hospital that fixed my brain tumors, this amazing trip to the most beautiful place. And the gist of it was rising from the depths of despair and knowing that even if your life is as bad as you think it could be, if you can hold yourself together enough to wait it out and see what happens, that you'll be shown some sort of path, some little piece of light will come in through the shards of brokenness and show you that it'll be okay. I don't like this version of okay sometimes. I want Molly back. I ask her to come back every day still. But Jack and the whole process of having him, I really do think saved me in a much bigger way than a brain tumor. I think he just saved me from not really being able to move along from Molly. Does he replace Molly? Not even close. Second children don't replace the first children. They just add to the mix. And Jack just evens the score. I've had a baby boy and then two baby girls and a baby boy. So I've got two of each. It's all even and neat. And here I am. So am I perfect? Oh, heck no. Am I a good mother? I do the best I can. Do I yell and scream at Jack sometimes? Darn right I do. Am I so sad that I can't function? Yes, I have those days. Do I sometimes drink too much? Indeed, I do. Not like before. I go weeks and weeks without. I'm so much healthier physically. I don't want to ever disrupt that. But, you know, I had the worst of the worst. Molly woke up April 30th alive, and May 1st, she was dead. And from then on, it's been this crazy journey. So, you know, that's my story. Is it a typical story? No. Can all 57-year-old women have babies? No. Do all 13-year-old girls die of brain tumors? No. But all of this is a part of my story. And it involves enough people and things and circumstances that I think sharing it, I think, can be helpful to a lot of people. At least that's what I hope.
Ooh, that's overwhelming, Barb.
Yes, it is.
You know, and you share that story so brilliantly well. Like, you help hold yourself together, given the years of the trauma and the up and the down and the, you know, the pain. Like, me hearing that for 45 minutes, It's like, you know, trying to go through, I don't know, a decade of or whatever it is of this,
right?
The emotional journey. It's like, whew, just been on this rocket. And yet it's a journey of just hope and miracles. You know, when you were describing the up and the down nature, the worst of it, the best of it, I see this all the time. You know, life is two sides of a coin. You know, we can't have the dark without the light. We can't understand how far we can rise unless we've actually gone really low. It feels like your journey is a really perfect demonstration or illustration of life.
Yes, absolutely. The opening line of a Charles Dickens book, I can never remember the name of the book, but it's the first line is, it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. And if I had to have a t-shirt with a saying on it that was my life, I think that would be it, you know. Mm-hmm. And you've only heard 2016 to now. You know.
And yet you're radiating joy. You've got a beautiful boy who's coming up to 3 years of age, is he?
No, he just two? Turned two.
Just
he
turned two,
March
sorry.
20th. Yep.
Oh,
yep.
Of course. Beautiful. And lucky you.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, lucky me. In a million different ways, lucky me. I've had a difficult life, but I find levity and humor to be very, very settling and grounding for me. Another book quote that I love, there's a book by Ken Kesey called One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And one of the main characters is this big Native American guy named Chief. It takes place in a mental hospital. And he says, if you lose your laughter, you lose your footing. And that's another one. I remember the week that Molly was on life support, I laughed so much that week because I was just getting this wonderful experience with everyone that knew her. And I had some friends who couldn't understand how I could laugh. Mm-hmm. And I felt like, how can I not laugh? Like, if I don't laugh, I'm not gonna make it.
Yeah. It sounds like you've learned a lot about yourself and found ways to balance yourself and ground yourself. You've got a very strong connection with yourself through this whole process. And I love the way that you listened and you opened to the journey, right?
Right.
This is life. And not just the journey, the moments of the connectedness, you know, the synchronicities, the messages, the signs, and just allowing the flow and being open.
Yeah. And I'm not always good at sitting still and listening. Yeah, you know, I'm a mile a minute all the time, but this has taught me, you know, for a while I couldn't move. And in those moments where I was just hobbled by it, I learned to listen. Mm. I sometimes say I learned to listen with my eyes and see with my ears. You know, life just becomes so different you have to look around things sometimes or manage everything in a different way. Mm. And so, right. Another beauty, you know, I thank Molly all the time. I don't thank her for dying, but I thank her for helping me figure out how to live without her here. That's not always easy. I just want her back.
Of course you do. Yeah. That won't change. But what will change is what you see tomorrow, what you experience tomorrow, you know, through her passing, the joy, the gifts, the magic, the tapestry that's been woven since has just been really beautiful.
That's the other thing, you know, starting my podcast for me, the one I do, has been a therapeutic exercise for me in self-learning and healing and self-forgiveness. Self-forgiveness is difficult when you lose a child. It's my job to keep her alive. I'm her mother. And so no matter what people tell me, I can always think of 50,000 things I could have done differently that would keep her alive, whether or not that's true. But I have met the most amazing people in this journey. And I will thank Molly tonight when we have our little pre-bed conversation for you and for Ian and for this whole foundation and organization that you have, because I get to be connected to something amazing. And the stories of the other people. I learned so much from listening to people that I would never have met if it weren't for all of this. And I have to focus on things that way. I have to look at it that way. That's another sort of survival tactic now, a healthier one, right?
Yeah, it's the right one. It's the best one. I totally agree. But, you know, I heard something on the weekend that really was playing on my mind a little bit, and I'm just reminded of it now. And that is that all suffering starts and ends when we are rejecting what's real, what's in the present moment, when we push away or we deny what we have, or we don't like it, we expect it to be something else. That's where suffering comes from.
Wow, that is so accurate.
And that's a choice. We can choose to accept what is in front of us.
Yes.
Or we can reject it. And that's when we suffer.
Yes. Yes. Wow. That's such an accurate illustration of what losing a child is like. You know, you have to reject it until you can wrap your head around it. And once you get to the point where you can just say, okay, she's never coming back. And that is the beginning. That is the turning point.
Yeah.
And that varies so much from mom to mom and dad to dad and all that. Mm-hmm. But you're right. That's a really, really articulate way of looking at it. I'm going to write that down later. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. You've shared just such an incredible story. And I heard you mention a book publisher. Are you writing a book?
Yes. Self-knowledge. I knew that I would never be organized enough to write it myself. So I have a very good friend who is a published author. She's from England. She's actually living in England for a year now, and she'll be back here in a few months. I hired her. You know, they lost their jobs in COVID and didn't think they could stay in the US. And I'm like, wait, I'm going to hire you to write a book. And so she ghost wrote my memoir around losing Molly, and all the different pieces, so much that I didn't share here because it's more Molly specific. But she had this beautiful job. She's an incredibly talented author. So we're in the final edits now and choosing a title and a cover and all of the details that will go into the final product. So, right. Another amazing learning experience.
Yeah.
So that's exciting.
Wonderful. I love it. You know, the journey continues with Molly, even though she's not here. It's her imprint in the fabric of life continues.
Exactly.
Barb, as we wrap this up, and I don't want to, I just want to keep, you know, talking to you. I just feel this like, you know, warmth. I feel like reaching out and giving you a hug and thanking you. And yeah, I always ask this question, and I know it might sound weird for me to ask this, but if there's people listening to this story, if there's any element of your story that they can relate to, because you've actually talked about a lot of challenges through this, is there something you'd like to share with them that might give them something?
I think in all of these things, dealing with Molly's death, wanting to have Jack, having Jack, finding brain tumors, experiencing organ transplants, the biggest piece of all of this for me has been two things. The willingness to take a first step. So my podcast is called 1,000 Tiny Steps. And it's because I believe that everything that happens to us is not a one-step incident. Thousands of steps lead us to everything. You and I started thousands of steps ago here. So the willingness to take the first step, even though it might not take you anywhere except a couple of inches across the carpet in your living room, right? Take the first step. The second and most important piece externally would be finding people to listen to you. Molly's biggest problem was she was only looked at as a skinny little 13-year-old girl. Had somebody looked at her and said, if she weren't a girl, what might I think? Her voice wasn't heard. And in all of the aspects of my journey, I've often felt that my voice hasn't heard. There is not only one doctor or one minister or one therapist or one nurse or one counselor in the world. There are hundreds. And if your voice isn't being heard, then find somebody who's willing to listen to you and willing to listen with their eyes and see you with their ears, if that makes sense. Sometimes it's not about what I look like or how old I am or what gender I am or any of those things. And so when people say to me, you know, how can I have what you have or how can I do it? I don't know, but I do know that everyone has a voice that deserves to be heard, and everybody can take one small step. Everybody can. I guess that's what I'd say. I mean, my experience is I'm very lucky. I have a body that did what I wanted it to do. Not everybody has that. I have a family that's supportive. Not everybody has that. But we all have a way to get to those things and get to what we want. And so that would be it. It just starts with a small step and finding somebody to listen to you.
It's beautiful. It's really lovely. Thank you.
Thank you.
So appreciate your energy and your heart and your time, Barb, and everything that you're doing and giving to other people as a result of the millions of steps that you've taken on your journey.
Right. Well, it's the only time I feel okay about it. If it doesn't mean anything, then why did it happen? I guess I reap the benefits all the time. You know, I'll go to sleep happy tonight because this was a wonderful conversation. Thank you for letting me talk about her.
You're so welcome. I think you should do it more then, if that's what makes you happy. Just keep doing it. Keep sharing. It's a beautiful story and it needs to be heard by many people. Thank you so much for your courage. It's been a pleasure talking with you today.
Well, it's been a pleasure here too. Thank you for inviting us.
Thanks.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Kintsugi Heroes. Please like and share the show to your friends so we can get this out to even more people. If you have a story you'd like to share with us, please reach out using the contact details below. And join us next week for our next Heroes story. Until then, keep being you and remember that we are all heroes in our own unique way.
Only when it's broken. Only when you're broken. Only when